Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. We are going to break script this week because we have got a fascinating, in-depth interview coming up with Tamika Hobbs, who is the author of Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. She is the executive director of the A. Philip Randolph Institute at Edward Waters College and speaks with the Florida Humanities Speakers Bureau on a topic, Strange Fruit in Florida, Racial Violence in the Sunshine State, playing off of the Billie Holiday song lyric. Before we get to that, I want to remind you that Welcome to Florida, as always, is brought to you by Sarasota and Visit Sarasota. Fall is the perfect time to get down to Sarasota. The big winter crowds have yet to arrive. The summer heat is past. So whether it's Moat Marine, whether it's St. Armand Circle, whether it's the Celery Fields for bird watching, Myakka River State Park, visit Sarasota.com to learn more and find Sarasota on social media, as well as windstormproducts.com, our newest sponsor, windstormproducts.com, a small Florida company that has built itself into the world's largest online supplier of hurricane hardware. That's all the nuts and bolts and screws and wing nuts and drill bits and everything that you need to secure your home or business from hurricane wind damage. Whether you've got stucco, concrete, asphalt, masonry, doesn't matter. Windstormproducts.com has what you need to secure your home from hurricane damage. And even better yet, they offer help for the DIYers out there who are trying to do this themselves. Go to windstormproducts.com. You'll see the 800 number for advice right in the upper right-hand corner. And that takes us, Craig, to our guest this week, Tamika Hobbs.
I became aware of her and her tremendous work through the Florida Humanities Council, Florida Talks program, and followed up with her. Her book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, is just It's brilliant. It's very disturbing. It's very dark, but it's necessary reading these days.
Buckle in.
Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this very difficult subject, but a very necessary subject, especially with the governor and the legislature trying to clamp down on any discussion of Florida's racial past. What sort of drew you into writing about this?
So my kind of origin story with my path to becoming a historian and to the research on lynching has to do with me deciding as a college senior to attend Florida A&M University in Tallahassee. It's a historically Black university. And it was while I was there that I took my very first African-American history class and was absolutely mesmerized. There was so much information there that I had not known before that was tremendously inspiring to me. When I think about Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass, Mary McLeod Bethune, so on and so forth, it was just really so new, and it presented the history and the strivings of my people in a way that I had not known before. But simultaneously, even as a 19-year-old, I was quite outraged that someone had made the decision that in all of my K-12 years, that the only people I needed to know about was really Martin Luther King and you know, a little bit about Frederick Douglass. And it was so impactful that I actually changed my major. I had gone to receive a Master's of Business Administration from the School of Business and Industry, but I changed my major in history. I kept taking courses. I kept being exposed to some really fantastic history faculty. And it was another class a few years later with Dr. Theodore Hemingway, who since passed away, where we were getting into the history of Reconstruction and the history of lynching. And you can imagine, again, for someone who was untutored, who really didn't understand these dynamics in American history, to be presented with this information was quite overwhelming. And I can remember it was a summer class. When we were discussing this, he turned to me and said that, "I bet you don't know that they lynched a boy in Live Oak," which is where I'm from, in Suwannee County. And of course, I had no idea And it was a quite a direct call out, as was his tradition, but it made a deep impact on me. And so the next time that I went home, I stopped by to visit my grandfather, and I was like, hey, you know, we were in class one day, and my professor told me that a boy was lynched here in Live Oak. And you have to understand that for my grandparents and really my parents, we did not have conversations about race explicitly. I have come to understand that as a generational compromise. My grandparents lived through segregation. My parents lived through segregation. My brother and I are the first generation in our family never to have attended segregated schools. And I think a part of achieving that dream for my family in their minds meant that they would not burden us with the sorry tales of their past. I understand the intention. We could maybe have another conversation about the disservice that they unintentionally did to myself and so many other. There are many, many people in my generation who have similar experiences. So for me to go home and ask my grandfather about lynching was a very different kind of conversation. And my grandfather was a minister. He'd worked for years at Occidental, the mine. He was a very commanding person, very stern. You know, kind of ran our family with a heavy hand.
The patriarch.
When I asked him about that, like I really saw him practically shrink in front of me. He got really quiet. He sat down and he said to me in a soft voice, he said, yeah, baby. And he was like, yeah, I remember when that happened. There was a time when I would be walking to town. If I encountered a white woman, I would turn around and go back home. And that's really all he really said about that at the moment. He would have been a contemporary of Willie James Howard, who was at the age of 15 in 1944, forced to jump to his death in the Suwannee River for the alleged crime of having passed a love note to a white girl. Mm-hmm. What began to happen after that is my professor, because he was interested in the research, began to send me back to collect stories from people that I knew in the community who would have remembered Willie James Howard, didn't know that it would actually become my first foray as an oral historian. What I continue to learn is I talk specifically to Black men who would have been Black boys around the time that Willie James Howard was murdered, is that the story of what happened to him, and we're talking about 11 years before Emmett Till, we know the Till name and the Till story very, very well, that the story of Willie James Howard became a cautionary tale for young Black men in that community. And it did the work, right? When we talk about the terroristic racial violence that was lynching, it really wasn't always about the individuals who were deprived of their civil rights, deprived of due process, and murdered. It was about the larger effect of sending a message to the broader Black community that if you stepped out of line, that this too could happen to you. Fast forward, after I graduated, I decided that I wanted to pursue my master's and PhD degree. And you have to make that decision about what you want to study. And I decided that I would pick up and continue these curious tidbits that I'd learned as an undergraduate about lynching in Florida, particularly during the 1940s. So that's how I came into it.
Yeah, a lot of people don't necessarily think of Florida as a southern state like that, but Florida had a really awful reputation for lynching, didn't it?
It absolutely did. There have been scholars who have crunched these numbers over the years. There was a publication back in the 80s that first presented these numbers. Tolney and Beck were the scholars. And even more recently, with the Equal Justice Initiative, the numbers are consistent. I will say at a base level, with EJI, they have uncovered at least an additional 50 lynchings in the state of Florida. That puts us around, last count, about 330 of my lynchings that have taken place in the state. Now, it's interesting when you look at those raw numbers, they are surpassed in other states like a Mississippi, like a South Carolina, But something interesting happens when you calculate the likelihood of Black people of being lynched in the South. And both for the Tolley and Beck study and the updated numbers for EJI, Florida far surpasses that rate of lynching, which means, if we translate that, that African Americans living in the state of Florida had the highest likelihood of being lynched of any people in the United States.
Wow.
The other thing that I have paired with that, I was doing some other work related to the Klan and its presence in Florida. If you realize that in 1920, with the rebirth of the KKK, that when we look nationwide, that membership stood at about 100,000 members, but that fully one third of the membership of the national KKK was in the state of Florida as well.
Boy.
So you put those two things together and it flips so much of what we think we understand about the Sunshine State, quote unquote, mm-hmm. on its yeah. head, right? Yeah. You know, we've done a tremendous marketing job painting ourselves as a tourist destination, the place of beaches, the place of Disney. And there's this deep belief that Florida is somehow exceptional when it comes to the South as we yeah. know it as a stereotype. But when you look at the plight and the lives of Black people in this state, it tells a very different story. There is a very deep consistency with Florida as a deep South state, yeah. especially as it concerned racial terrorism.
I had that very conversation with a guest to my home in Fernandina Beach, friends of my wife, and they were from Georgia. And we got to talking about current events and the podcast and everything I've learned. And you know, what the comment is, but that wasn't really Florida, right? And I was like, oh no, that was Florida. This is, you know, the first civil rights martyr, one of three places Martin Luther King was arrested, this lynching history, the prominence of the Ku Klux Klan, people who consider themselves educated. I'm going to put myself in this category as well. Prior to digging in on this history, like you said, thought Florida was exceptional somehow. And then, you know, at the state line, racism stopped. And down here, it was beaches and Disney and good times and oranges. Not the case.
Yeah, I mean, that is a common understanding that you can cash in on. But it definitely sugarcoats a whole lot of really bad stuff. And I think that's important to recognize, too, when I talk to people about this. And really try to help connect the dots about systems. Because while a lot has changed, our systems are still very much in place. When you ask yourself, why was lynching violence in Florida? Why was lynching violence in the South able to continue? What you have to appreciate, number one, is the consistent effort, the terroristic efforts that were exercised to reduce Black voting rights. After they were able to run Black people away from the polls by hook or by crook, first through violence to reduce the numbers, then once you have the numbers and have control over the legislature, over the constitutional process, as we see in 1889, you build in all types of legal measures that are going to prohibit African-American men at this point from being able to vote. And what you're going to see is a pretty rash reduction in the ability of Black men to participate in government from the time that they were able to participate, roughly 1868 in the state, through the end of Reconstruction. You're going to see African-American men serve at nearly every level of government here in the state, city, county, even in Tallahassee. You have someone like Jonathan Gibbs, who was both Secretary of State and Superintendent of Education. Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot of people know that. It's quite phenomenal when you think about it. But by the time that they finish undoing all of this, there's a very stark difference. For Florida, when we see Josiah T. Walls, who had been elected to represent Florida in Washington, D.C., when he leaves, I believe his term ends in 1871. Florida does not send another African-American to Washington, D.C. until 1992 with the election of Carrie Meek. Wow. So we have a span of 115 years of no Black representation from the state in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's remarkable. We had an episode on the KKK in Florida weeks ago, and our guest at that time said one of the reasons the KKK fizzled out is because largely they got what they were after legislatively. Yeah. They won, for lack of a better way to put it. And one of the things that I only realized recently is that you just reinforced as well. When you look at Black representation in politics, Black homeownership, Black small business ownership, that really reached a peak in the late 1800s that, like you said, took 100 years to come back to those levels, if we've even gotten back to those levels. So I think a lot of people don't realize that Black people in representation and a lot of these equality measures were being achieved before they were taken away again around the turn of the century.
I would actually argue against that. And one of my frustrations as a historian is that there are people who understand that, because so much of what we see on the landscape today, these are the same plays from a very old playbook. And so when we talk about the continuation of the threats to voting rights for Black people, this is something that we saw during the period of Reconstruction, when the red rug was being pulled out from under us, when there was a deliberate and intentional desire to make sure that there was a return to quote unquote home rule, and that states' rights superseded federal rights. That also points to another very important, you know, correlation, which is when it comes to Black folks and their ability to advance their rights in this society, it has been because of the intervention of the federal government that has provided the protections to make sure that they were able to vote and that their civil rights were protected. And so there's always this tension. And what you see consistently over the years, anytime that you see efforts to subjugate Black people or to lessen their voice or to lessen their influence, they follow some of the same trends and strategies in order to make that come about. The other thing that's a part of this is also important to uplift, especially when you look at the history of Florida, is the motivation for so much of this. A lot of it was economic, because the economy of the state, whether we're talking about turpentine in the north, whether we're talking about the orange groves that are going to populate further in central Florida, celery, beans, tobacco, like the area where I grew up, those economies relied on a readily available source of cheap labor. And making sure that people were disenfranchised, making sure that they were paid low wages, and making sure that they were terrorized in such a way that they would not threaten the status quo, all were formulas that worked together. And I think it's always important, and I do this when I talk to people, to uplift the role of law enforcement in all of this during the time period that we're dealing with in the, you know, in the late 20th century, early and late 20th century. Law enforcement was the engine, was the arm of the enforcement of these terrible laws. And these are the things that I really think are important for people to understand, because some of these same dynamics are with us. If people want to understand lynching violence, they have to, if they want to understand, excuse me, the Black Lives Matter movement, they need to understand a bit about lynching.
Yeah.
When I talk to audiences, people are completely stunned. They have no idea of the breadth and depth of this violence and what it meant. And then why would they? Because the narrative is that we are a nation of laws, that when a crime like this is committed, that certainly our legal system jumps into action. There's investigation. We find out who's guilty. There's arrest, there's indictment, there's a jury process. But in the case of society at one point in our history, and I would argue there's still echoes of this, if society decides that people are deserving of this treatment, if society decides that these people are innately criminal and probably can be assumed or presumed to have committed the things that they were accused of, there's a lot that can happen. There's a lot of evasion of due process that is allowed. And it's these types of interactions between our collective societal beliefs. If we really want to go deeper, we now have research and language to vivify this. Well, if we want to talk about implicit biases, and specifically implicit racial bias and the role that that plays in our criminal legal system, you begin to understand at a deeper level some of these dynamics. And it's critically important if we're ever going to make sure that we really and truly move towards being a inclusive, equitable, just society. And that is what disturbs me about what you mentioned at the beginning about the where we are in our state and laws that are effectively criminalizing these types of conversations.
Yeah, I hope we don't get raided while we're doing the podcast. Now, your book specifically focuses on four lynchings that took place in the 1940s, contrasting the violence at home with America's fight for democracy abroad during World War II. But let me ask you about one that occurred before that you do talk about some in the book, and that's Claude Neal. Can you tell us a little bit about that specific incident?
Claude Neal was lynched in Marianna, Jackson County, up in the Panhandle, and here in Florida, in 1934. He had been accused of the rape and murder of Lola Cannady, a young white girl in that community. We have subsequently learned that there were allegations that they had a consensual sexual interracial relationship, and that may have been the genesis of what happened. What happened in the case of Claude Neal was quite extraordinary in that after he was arrested, there was the real threat that he would be lynched because of the nature of the crime that he committed. And we can come back if you have time to talk about kind of this tension between the sexuality and sexual contact between Black men and white women. But that was the type of thing that would raise the ire of the community. And so there was an effort to try to protect the life of Claude Neal. So he was driven out of Jackson over into, I believe, Pensacola in the Panhandle. After that became compromised, they took him up to Alabama, Brewster, Alabama. They followed him there and were able to overpower the law enforcement officers that were attempting to protect his life and provide for a due process. What's really interesting to me about this is that as they were making their way back to the Cannady farm, there were messages that were going out over the radio to let people know in South Alabama, South Georgia, and North Florida that there was going to be a lynching. There were special train cars commissioned to ease the transportation for people who wanted to come down and witness what would happen to Claude Neal. It's really hard to imagine in today's society that type of thing happening, but it did happen in the case.
They were treating it like it was a big football game. Yeah, everybody come on down, come see the lynching.
Well, and one of the remarkable aspects of that, there were postcards of lynchings made at the time, which again, I forget what museum I saw that was. I think it was one in Louisville. But again, when I saw that, I was just astonished, just totally this, like you say, Craig, it's like greetings from the lynching. You know, I was there and here I am in the crowd and people would put arrows on to their face. And it's just hard to believe.
You have to, you know, to pause there. And that was James Allen's work. There was the exhibition, I think it originally was up in New York, but he subsequently published the book that was in the website. It was quite phenomenal, very, very powerful teaching tool. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, like, what kind of society was that? That, you know, what created those conditions? And again, it is the assumption of the innate criminality of Black folks. And everything that allows, it allows us to ignore our own laws and ignore our own stated processes and move forward with these types of murders and say that it's okay.
You talked about this sexuality angle between Black men and white women, and whether it's Emmett Till, a 10-year-old accused of whistling at a white woman for which he was lynched, or the Tulsa Race Massacre, or these incidents you talked about, so many of these. And, you know, speaking to your grandfather, when he'd see a white woman, he would turn around. Well, this is why. Because you could so easily, as a Black man, be accused and then murdered for even a sideways glance for doing nothing. You know, forget about actually doing anything. You could be accused of something as innocent as a head nod or a sideways glance and be murdered. Dig in a little on how prevalent and how common as a through line that is in all of these instances of lynching, really broadly throughout the South, not just in Florida during this period.
So I'll talk about the societal context of this post-emancipation, right? Because one of the biggest fears after, you know, 4 million formerly enslaved people are emancipated, you know, gradually, right, through the announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation, but finally with the ratification of the 13th Amendment in December of 1965, 62,000 of them are in the state of Florida. And then you fast forward with the 14th Amendment, them becoming citizens, and then the 15th Amendment granting Black men the right to vote. The prospect for white men, right, in this patriarchal society is, number one, that you're now facing the prospect of people who you thought to be at every level, whether we talk about intellectually, biologically, in every way inferior to you, now have not only the ability to circulate in the society, to be in spaces where you are in space, but now have the ability to run for office and make laws that might govern your lives. And when you consider the reality of slavery and what it meant, enslavement and the legal process, the social process, the lived reality for, you know, almost 2.5 centuries in this country, and the liberties that white people were able to take with the bodies and lives of Black folks. One of the deepest legacies that people don't speak about when we talk about enslavement is the use and abuse of Black women. Part of the new civics literacy excellence initiative that has been rolled out here in the state of Florida downplays the institution of slavery. And one of the points that is made, which in some ways is factual, is that when you look at the scope, not simply of the transatlantic slave trade, but slavery as an international human phenomenon, that there were just so few people who were brought to the United States. There were many more that were taken to the Caribbean, that were taken to Brazil. But you have to ask yourself the next question, because there were, you know, 6 million in the Caribbean, I believe like 4 million that went to Brazil, 500,000 that we roughly count that came to the shores of what became the United States. But the United States has one of the largest Black populations outside of the continent of Africa. Why was that the case? How do you get from 500,000 in the period of the slave trade to 4 million? It's through reproduction and the forced breeding of Black women. Not only the forced breeding of Black women, but you have to pair that with laws that turn centuries of family law on its head. It is in the United States that for the first time you have a law that says that the status of a child follows that of the mother. That flies in the face of so much tradition. What's the motivation for a law like that? Well, if you know that as a white slave owner, you are raping your slaves and that there are children who are being produced from those unions that might eventually take you to court for their freedom and for property. If you nip that pathway to freedom in the bud by saying that the status of the child follows the status of the mother, as we see in colonial Virginia in 1662, it opens the path for a lot. So I say that to say that as a white man in the 1870s, imagining what Black rule might mean, there is a hyper-focus of guilt that is in the forefront of the white imagination that if given the ability to lead and potentially to dominate in society and in law, that Black men will do to white women what white men did to Black women. And that is a fundamental patriarchal preoccupation among white men. Now, and that's what they say for decades, right? As lynching violence continues to proliferate throughout the region, and there are people outside of the South, in the North, in the West, Midwest, who question, why are you doing this? And the number one defense that you will hear from folks like Theodore Bilbo, Sidney Katz here in the state of Florida, is that if these Black men just left our white women alone, they wouldn't get lynched. We have to lynch them. We have to terrorize them to keep this deadline between Black men and white women.
It's the victim's fault. They made us do that. Yeah.
And it took, though, a Black investigative journalist, one of my favorite figures in American history, Ida B. Wells, to begin to interrogate this, because, and I have a lot of kinship. I think when I look at the phenomenon of mass incarceration in the modern United States, there were many years in my life where I just assumed that there were more African Americans who were selling drugs and using drugs, and that's why there were so many Black people in jail. When in fact, Black people and white people, we now know because of Michelle Alexander and her book, The New Jim Crow, and the research that has followed that, Black people and white people use and sell drugs at the same rate. It is simply the choices that our law enforcement officials make in terms of where they capture the judges, the prosecutors, the decisions they make and how they charge, the choice between jail or treatment. And who's given what options. All of those factors contribute to the larger phenomenon. Likewise, Ida B. Wells began to question what she assumed. I think she assumed that at one point that Black men really were out here terrorizing white women. But when she began to collect the data and show up at the scenes where there had been lynchings, when she crunched those numbers, what she found is that in less than a quarter of the cases had there been an accusation of rape or attempted rape. That Black men were being lynched for a number of different reasons. They were being accused of murder. But for some of them, they were accused of being uppity, that they were too successful, that they thought too much of themselves, that there was economic envy in the community around their ability to acquire land or operate successful businesses, that these too were justifications that were given for this. And even in one of the instances that I write about, the case of Jesse James Payne, who was killed in Madison in 1945, the roots of what got him killed was a disagreement between he and the landowner that he sharecropped for. He'd asked for an advance in order to, as the story goes, to buy medicine for his daughter, provide for his family. The landowner rebuked him. And Jesse James Payne made the mistake of threatening him, basically telling him, I know that you've planted more than your allotment under the Agricultural Adjustment Act. If I let them know, you know, you'd be in big trouble. They don't come to blows then, but the landowner gets two other white men later and goes out and kidnaps Jesse James Payne at gunpoint with the intention of killing him. The gun misfires. Payne is able to escape. He's on the lam, and the landowner is nervous. But what he does then is to say, hey, we have to get this guy because he attempted to rape my 5-year-old daughter. Something that is completely false. But he also could do that, number one, because of all the history I've just shared, knowing that it would bring white men out in droves to be a part of a posse to hunt him down and find him and probably kill him before they can bring him to justice. And no one would ask a question because everyone would assume that it was true. But for the intervention of a Florida State trooper, that mob would have been able to capture him. He was taken to Rayford. He was taken to safety. But it was when he was brought back to Madison County, I believe in October of that year, that he was kidnapped from a jail whose keys were known to be kept on the floorboard of the sheriff in his unlocked car, taken out and shot by the roadside. And so, again, it was an economic interpersonal dispute about money and crops that was then twisted into a false allegation of rape against a young girl, and it cost this man his life.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, a lot of the narrative about lynching is about victimhood, but there were efforts by Black people to fight back too, weren't there?
Sure. There were efforts. I think here in Florida, when I think about that, I think about the situation in Ocoee, because that really was in November of 1920, Black men, Mose Norman and July Perry, who even despite being threatened by the KKK, which had a statewide terroristic campaign leading into that election to try to dissuade not only Black women, but Black men, but Black women who had just been awarded the right to vote and who were registering by the droves to try to scare them away from the polls. But these men, one of whom I believe Mose Norman was a veteran of World War World I, were determined to exercise their right to vote and tried to push through. But ultimately, when we look at what happened, were overwhelmed and outgunned, and that resulted in the Ocoee massacre. So you do have instances of individuals who are trying to stand firm and fight against. Those do pop up time and time again. There's a really good book about from Carlos Hill, a researcher out in, I believe it's Arkansas, who writes about this and documents these instances. And so you do have these examples, these sparks of examples of Black men who are trying to stand up against fray. But the simple facts of demographics and gun ownership and access to justice, frankly, have meant that by and large, African-Americans were not able to protect themselves against this type of violence. So I'm not able to speak to very concrete examples of when that happened. But one reaction that we have is the Great Migration. When you look at, and Isabel Wilkerson has written about this beautifully in her book, The War of the Other Sons, there were numbers, you know, scores of Black people, millions of Black people that left the South for the North. And I think it's important to recast that, not just as people who are seeking, you know, better lives, better jobs, but were fleeing terroristic violence. That is what happened to the family of Jesse James Payne. When he dies, it throws his family into chaos. His wife, his children, his sisters, his mother, have lost their provider. And one of his brothers leaves Florida, changes his name, and starts a life for himself in Detroit. And it was in the process of writing the manuscript for my book back in, this would have been 2014, that I was able to reconnect with his family. I was conducting my research just as at the time that they were reconnecting the lines of their family tree. And I was able to learn about them and their aunt and the lives that they led and the family that they were disconnected from for decades, because this brother, in order to save his life after the lynching of his brother, decided that he needed to start over fresh. And again, that is not an uncommon story of all of people fleeing racial violence in the state of Florida and other southern states. And moving north.
Was the Jackson County War, was that an attempt to fight back?
I would say yes. Again, ultimately not successful. This is going to be one of those stories that's coming in the years after emancipation, roughly 1869 to 1871, again in Jackson County. The roots of that conflict were about the political struggle, the Republicans, the party of Lincoln. And now that Black people are emancipated and entering politics, it is going to be the party that they choose. The Republicans were very effective at organizing there and had sent a Black senator to Washington, to Tallahassee. Black representatives, Black elected officials were abounded in that community. But there was a former Confederate general and a Klan leader there that made it his business to undo. And he said it was his mission was to kill every Republican that he possibly could.
Dang.
And so between those years, you're going to see nearly 170 people, we believe, were murdered. Black, white men, women, and children are dying in this conflict over who would control Jackson County politics. And ultimately, the white power structure, white Democrats, Klan members, former Confederates are going to be able to overwhelm and overpower in that situation. So I guess that's why, in my mind, it doesn't automatically trigger a success story of Black people fighting back. But they were given, in some cases, as good as they got. But in the final measure, white supremacy was able to be reestablished.
A lot of what you hear today around this conversation goes something like this. As 100 years ago, we're past that. It's over. Let's move on. Let's not relive these terrible stories and be at each other's throats again. Why is that flawed thinking?
There's a lot about our society that changes over time. Our technology changes, our economy shifts. But the basic human nature and dynamics of our power structure have not changed. And we have to understand those if we are to really achieve true equity in this society. When you often look at statistics that involve race, African Americans are at the bottom of the good list and at the top of the bad list. And what happens is that without an accurate accounting of history, Black people get blamed for their failures in this society. When, you know, as I said, I am the first generation in my family to never have attended segregated schools. First time out of the gate, I have a terminal degree, a PhD in United States history. This is not because I'm the smartest person to ever been produced in my bloodline. My grandmother was a rock star, Cleo McDaniel Gribbage. She accomplished anything that she put her mind to, despite debilitating conditions, genetic disorder that ultimately cost her her hearing. She was fantastically creative and driven. There is nothing special about me except that I had opportunity. People like to forget that because when we think about school desegregation, we think about 1954 and Black and white pictures. We do not account for the fact that here in the state of Florida, there were 20 years of resistance, which meant that it was not until my parents were in high school that they were finally integrated into the white school. And even then, the resentment of their presence, the way that it affected their classroom learning, the way that that affected racial bigotry, the advice that they were given by guidance counselors, shaped the trajectory of their lives. Those are the deeper stories that we need to talk about. When we talk about the racial wealth gap in this country, in which the average white household, depending on the figure and the number, is holding either 10 times or 19 times the average wealth in the Black household. And I like to, when I was teaching, tell my students that included Oprah, LeBron, everybody. You put all the money together. Yeah. And this is the differential. And I think people look at that and would blame Black folks, but we haven't talked about the way that the federal government deprived African Americans of federal loans for home ownership because of redlining in the 1940s and 50s, when we know it is common knowledge in our economy that home ownership is one of the main avenues towards wealth accumulation. Black folks were denied that. So, and it is not through any lack of striving on our part. And I think that is the gift that African-American history gave to me, is that I had so many unanswered questions in my mind around the lack in my community and the wealth in the white community. And just as I've said already, in the absence of any other contextual information, it will automatically lead you to assume that the reason that Black people don't have more is because they don't want more. What I learned in those African American history classes is that Black people, you know, since they have had contact with Europeans that resulted in their enslavement, have been fighting a beautiful struggle for their humanity, for their freedom, for advancement in amazingly creative ways, but these systems and these structures have really weighed on them. And I think it's a source of inspiration. I think for me, in the darkest moments of my life, I consider what magic my DNA holds. It is an absolute miracle that I am here and healthy and somewhat whole. And when I think about this continuing fight, if I can apply, you know, a tenth of the grit that my ancestors applied in these situations that are dramatically improved from what they knew, I get excited about the possibilities for my descendants and the possibilities from this country, because what I was taught is that we believed in the value of diversity, that we really and truly believe that one ought to be rewarded for one's efforts, and that you can be anything that you want to be. There have been events in recent American history that have illuminated that those promises were probably not full-throated.
Good way to put it.
But I think that we are, all of us, will determine the future of this country and who we are really going to be. on my most optimistic days, I believe that we can actually live up to those promises. On my most pessimistic days, I see the shadows of the terroristic violence and the racist society that fuel the lynching that I've written about in previous decades, experiencing a resurgence. And it makes me absolutely frightened for the lives of my two Black male sons and for all of us. Yeah. For all of us.
Before we leave this topic, I wanted to ask you about probably maybe the most prominent victim of racial violence in Florida, but also one of the most forgotten, Harry T. Moore and his wife.
Yes. One of them, I'd have to say, frankly, one of my favorite figures in Florida's Black history. I already talked about Ida B. Wells. I feel a special affinity for Harry T. Moore for a number of reasons. He's also a native of Suwanee County, as am I. I spent roughly 9 years with Florida Memorial University, which is in Miami-Dade County and Miami Gardens, but was founded in Suwanee County in 1879. And Harry T. Moore was a graduate of the class of 1925 of that institution when it was still located in Live Oak, Florida. Was the top of his class. When I think about all the evidence of his advocacy, from writing for justice and advocating for justice for lynching victims, there are many letters that we had to read and quote in my book, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, from Harry T. Moore in pleading for justice. When I look at his role in the fight to equalize teacher pay in Florida during the 1930s and 40s, when Black teachers were paid roughly half of what white teachers were paid during the school year. Probably one of the most remarkable facts of his career have to do with the co-founding of the Progressive Voters League on the heels of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Smith versus Allwright, which struck down the all-white primary as an anti-democratic process throughout the South. Between 1944 and when he was assassinated in 1951, Harry T. Moore and that organization were responsible for registering something like 110,000 African Americans to vote in the South.
Wow, that's amazing.
Absolutely tremendous, especially when you consider, right, that this is many years before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which really kind of blows the whole thing open. When I think about all of those very diverse levels of activism, he's the first state president of the Florida Conference of the NAACP. He knew that what he was doing put his life in danger, and he did it anyway. And he died, he and his wife, so terribly tragically when that bomb was placed under their house on Christmas night in 1951, with him dying within a few hours and his wife, Harriet, lingering for about 9 days before she passed away. Mm. And, you know, we know the story of martyrs like Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers. But I wish, to your point, Craig, that more people and more Floridians knew about the life and legacy and striving of Harry T. Moore. I've been very encouraged. I had the chance to represent Florida Memorial University last year in my hometown when they erected a historic marker acknowledging the life and legacy of Harry T. Moore. It was a full circle moment. We were not actually very far from the home of the Howard family. Of Willie James Howard family.
Oh, wow.
And I sat there quite overwhelmed when I thought about the fact that he was being recognized for his work in a place that was a very tough place for Black people.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I agree with you. He deserves a lot more study.
Maybe we should take down all the Confederate monuments and put up monuments to Harry T. Moore.
I would love to see that. I think he deserves to have a statue right there on the courthouse square in Suwanee County. And hey, maybe I'll reach back out to you. One of my good buddies and I've been threatening that for some years, but it would be long overdue.
Oh, yeah.
Harry T. Moore's name is not as well known as it should be. One name that is very well known, I want to ask you if he was lynched and if racial lynchings in Florida continue today, and that's Trayvon Martin.
Trayvon Martin, I would say perhaps that is not the most direct example of lynching. For years, after he was killed and many years after, really struggled. as a historian, you try to maintain some objectivity. And I don't like the practice of taking, you know, historical terms and applying them to contemporary situations, because there's just so much complication. But the through line that I see there, and there are many in that case, is, as I've already said, the presumed criminality of Trayvon Martin that came to dominate any other narrative about who he was. It is for me a continuation of a very painful history. Related to that is the vigilantism that I saw demonstrated by George Zimmerman. And I actually saw it more keenly. The incident that actually seems more like a lynching to me is what happened to Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia. But in both of those cases, for the pursuers and the murderers of Ahmaud Arbery, for George Zimmerman, who murdered Trayvon, there was this empowerment of fueled by whiteness and the privileges of whiteness that allowed these men to believe that they had the ability to control the movements of Black folks, up into and including killing them, and that they would be justified in doing that. And that's the work and part of what we have benefited from, in my opinion, when we look at the research and the strivings over, say, the last generation by scholars like Derek Bell, like Kimberly Crenshaw, and others who've given us critical race theory. Their critical analysis of the American legal system through a racialized lens has helped to illuminate and give name to patterns of behavior that have resulted in the subjugation and brutalization of Black folks and the consistent access and control of power by white people in this country. And one of the things that's coming out of that is understanding whiteness as a legal and social construct that only exists in opposition to Black people and people of African descent. The only reason that British people, French people, Italian people eventually, Polish people eventually have become white is to benefit in our society from the privileges that are associated with being white, that are demonstrable. And to unpack all of that is what we need to understand. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think it's so important for people to understand lynching, to be able to put these very painful continuations into context, in hopes that we all can join hands and work to eradicate what exists in our subconscious mind that gets activated as we gatekeep, as we vote, as we go about the making of our society and our government, in order to really and truly include achieve equity for more people than just instead of just
You talk about those demonstrable benefits of being white. It goes without saying, and we didn't even mention that, obviously, no one was ever tried, charged, or did any time for these lynchings that we've talked about, I would guess 99%. So right there is an example of how the judiciary is also one of these structures, one of these systems upholding white power. We don't do two-part episodes. We try to rein this in under an hour. I'm going to force myself to say goodbye. I Craig and I obviously could go on and on and on and on. Tamika Hobbs, author, Democracy Abroad, Lynching at Home, Racial Violence in Florida. We'll put links to how folks can find you in the show notes. Thank you so much for opening up with us on this topic today.
This has been great. Thank you very much
for the invitation. Thank you for being willing to listen.
I don't really know where to go from there, Craig, other than to say goodbye, because there's very little else we could add. The episode on 1980 in Miami with Arthur McDuffie comes to mind. Florida's most racist sheriff comes to mind. So many of our episodes, gosh, American Beach, KKK in Florida a couple of weeks ago. That's enlightening.
I would just mention that there is an effort now to recognize the lynching victims and to put up markers commemorating their their assassination, I guess you'd say. They just did one in Hillsborough County just this past week.
Really?
And I think it's important to remind people this happened. These people lived, these people died, and what happened to them was wrong. And we need to remember that because, you know what they say about people who forget the past.
Mm-hmm. They are doomed to repeat it. And it feels like we are repeating history here in 2022. Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.